Chapter 17. There is no part of the fiesta that appeals to the spectator seeing bullfights for the first time, as does the placing of the banderillas. The eye of a person unfamiliar with the bullfight cannot really follow the cape work. There is the shock of seeing the horse struck by the bull, and no matter how this affects the spectator, he will be liable to continue to watch the horse and miss the quite that the matador has made. The work with the muleta is confusing. The spectator does not know which passes are difficult to make, and, it all being new, his eye is hardly competent to distinguish one move from another. He watches the muleta as something picturesque, and the killing may be done so suddenly that unless the spectator has very trained eyes, he will not be able to break up the different figures and see what really happens. Often enough, too, the killing will be done so without style or sincerity, the matador making as little of it as he can in order to decrease its importance, that the spectator will have no idea of the emotion and the spectacle that a properly killed bull will give. But the placing of the banderillas he sees clearly. He follows it easily in all its details, and almost invariably, when it is well done, he enjoys it. In the banderillas, he sees a man walk out carrying two slender sticks with barbed points. The first man he has seen go toward the bull without a cape in his hands. The man attracts the bull's attention. I am describing the simplest way of planting banderillas. Runs toward him as the bull charges, and as bull and man come together and the bull lowers his head to hook the man, puts his feet together, raises his arms high, and drives the shafts straight down into the lowered neck of the bull. That is as much of it as the spectator's eye can follow. Why doesn't the bull get him, someone seeing their first fight or even after many fights will ask. The answer is this. The bull cannot turn in a shorter space than his own length. Therefore, if the bull charges, once the man has passed the horn, he is safe. He may pass the horn by taking a course which brings him at an angle toward the bull's course, judging the moment of encounter when he puts his feet together so that the bull's head is down, sinking the sticks, and pivoting on them past the horn. This is called placing them poder a poder, or force to force. The man may start from a position so that he makes a quarter of a circle as he crosses the bull's charge, thus placing them al cuarteo, the commonest way. Or he may stand still and await the bull's charge, the finest way of planting them, and as the bull reaches him in his charge and is about to lower his head to hook, the man lifts the right foot and sways to the left so that the bull follows the lure of his body, then sways back, brings his right foot down, and drives down the sticks. This is called placing the banderillas al cambio. It may be done, of course, to either the right or left. The way I have described it, the bull would pass to the left. There is another variation of this called al quiebro, in which the man is not supposed to lift either foot, deceiving the bull and giving him the false direction with the movement of his body, the feet kept still. But I have never seen this done. I have seen many pairs of banderillas that the critics called al quiebro, but I have never seen one placed without the man raising either one foot or the other. In all these ways of placing the banderillas, there are two men with capes in different parts of the ring. In general, a matador in the center, and another, either matador or banderillero, in the rear of the bull, so that when the man has planted the banderillas and passed the bull's horn, by whatever means he has chosen, the bull, as he turns to pursue him, will see a cape before he has made his turn and taken out after the man. There is a definite place in the ring that each of the two or three men with capes occupies in all of the various ways of placing banderillas. The ways I have described, the cuarteo, or quarter of a circle, power to power and its variations, in both of which the man and bull are both running, and the cambio and its variations, in which the man stands still and awaits the bull's charge, are the usual ways of placing banderillas in which the man seeks to perform brilliantly. They are usually the ones used by the matador when he takes the banderillas himself, and their effect depends upon the grace, cleanness, decision, and domination that the man puts into them, and the proper placing of the shafts. They should be placed high up on the top of the shoulders, well back behind the bull's neck. They should be sunk together, not spread apart, and they should not be placed where they will interfere with the sword thrust. Banderillas should never be placed in the wounds made by the picadors. A banderilla properly placed pierces the hide only, and the weight of the shaft causes it to hang down the bull's flank. If it is driven in too deep, it stands straight up, makes it impossible to work brilliantly with the bull with the muleta, and instead of a sharp prick that has no lasting effect, it makes a painful wound that discomposes the bull and makes him uncertain and difficult. There is no maneuver in the bullfight which has as object to inflict pain on the bull. The pain that is inflicted is incidental, not an end. The object of all the maneuvers, in addition to giving the most brilliant spectacle, is to try to tire the bull and slow him in preparation for the killing. I believe that part of the bullfight which inflicts most pain and suffering, some of it useless, on the bull, is the placing of the banderillas. Yet it is the part of the fight which causes least repugnance to American and British spectators. I believe this is because it is the easiest to follow and to understand. If all of the bullfight were as easy to follow, appreciate, understand, and see the danger of as is the placing of the banderillas, the attitude of the non-Spanish world toward the bullfight might be very different. In my own time, I have seen the attitude of American newspapers and popular magazines change greatly toward bullfighting by some presentation of it, as it is, or an honest attempt at this presentation in fiction. And this is before the son of a Brooklyn policeman had become a capable and popular matador. There are, in addition to the three ways of placing banderillas that I have described, at least 10 others, some of which have become obsolete, such as the man who is to place the banderillas sighting the bull with the chair in one hand, seating himself as the bull charges, rising from the chair to lure the bull to one side with a feint, driving in the banderillas, and then sitting again in the chair. This is almost never seen now, nor are various other ways of placing banderillas, which were invented by certain bullfighters and, being rarely executed well except by their inventors, passed into disuse. Bulls that take up a querencia against the barrera cannot be banderillaed by the use of the quarter or the half-circle method of running across the line of the bull's charge, placing the sticks as the man's line of movement crosses that of the bull's. Since the man after passing the horn would be caught between the bull and the barrier, and such bulls must be banderillaed on this bias, or al sesco. In this maneuver, the bull being against the barrera, one man should be in the passageway with a cape to attract the bull's attention until the man who is to place the banderillas starts at an angle from farther down the barrera, plants his banderillas as he passes the bull's head without stopping as best he can. Often he has to vault the barrera if the bull takes after him. There is a man farther out in the ring with a cape to try to pick the bull as he turns, but since bulls that necessitate this maneuver are usually those that are liable to make for the man rather than the lure, often the man with the cape is comparatively useless. Bulls which will not charge, or in charging cut in on the man, or those which are nearsighted, are banderillaed by what is called the media vuelta, or half-turn. In this way of placing, the banderillero comes close behind the bull, calls the bull's attention, and as the bull revolves toward the man and drops his head to hook the man, who is already in motion, drives in the banderillas. This is only an emergency method of placing them, since it violates the principle of the bullfight that the man should, in accomplishing any maneuvers with the bull, approach him from the front. Another way of placing the banderillas that you still sometimes see is what's called a relance. That is when the bull is still running and tossing after the placing of a pair of banderillas, the man takes advantage of this running, as distinct from a charge he has provoked deliberately, to cut in on it in a half or quarter circle and place another pair. The matador usually takes the banderillas himself when he thinks the bull is one that he can perform brilliantly with. In former times, a matador took the banderillas only when the crowd asked him to. Now placing the banderillas is a part of the regular repertoire of all matadors who have the necessary physique, and who have taken the time to learn to banderillar well. In the preparation of the bull alone, sometimes drawing the bull on by running backwards and zigzags, these sudden shifts of direction being the defense of a man on foot against the bull, seeming to play with him while they place him where they want him, then challenging him arrogantly, walking steadily and slowly toward him, and then when the charge comes, either awaiting it or running in to meet it, a matador has an opportunity to impress his personality and his style on all that he does in this third of the fight. A banderillero, however, even though he might be more skillful than his master, has only one instruction, aside from advice as to where to place them in the animal, to put them in quickly and properly so that the bull will be delivered as soon and in the best condition possible to his master, the matador, for the last and final act. Most banderilleros are good at placing the sticks from either one side or the other. It is very rarely that a man is able to banderillar properly from both sides. For this reason, a matador will carry one banderillero who is best on the right and another who is good on the left. The best banderillero I have ever seen was Manuel García Maera. He with Joselito and Rodolfo Gaona, the Mexican, were the greatest of modern times. A peculiar thing is the overwhelming excellence of all Mexican bullfighters with the banderillas. For the last few years, each season there have come to Spain from 3 to 6 unknown Mexican apprentice bullfighters, any one of whom is as good as or better than the best artists with the banderillas in Spain. They have a style in their preparation and execution and an emotional quality that comes from the unbelievable chances they take that are, except for the Indian coldness of the rest of their work, the mark and characteristics of Mexican bullfighting. Rodolfo Gaona was one of the greatest bullfighters that ever lived. He was produced under the regime of Don Porfirio Díaz and worked in Spain exclusively during the years when the fights were suspended while Mexico was in revolution. He modified his early style in imitation of Joselito and Belmonte and competed with them on almost equal terms during the season of 1915, on equal terms in 1916, but after that, a horn wound and an unfortunate marriage ruined his career in Spain. He was steadily worse in his performances as a fighter while Joselito and Belmonte improved. The pace, he was not as young as they were, the new style, and his loss of morale caused by domestic difficulties were too much for him, and he returned to Mexico where he dominated all other bullfighters and served as a model for all the present crop of elegant Mexicans. Most of the youngest Spanish bullfighters have never seen either Joselito or Belmonte, only their imitators. But the Mexicans have all seen Gaona. In Mexico, he was also the master of Sidney Franklin, and Franklin's style with the cape, which so puzzled and amazed Spaniards when he first appeared, was formed and influenced by Gaona. Mexico is producing now, during another period without civil war, a quantity of bullfighters who may become great if the bulls leave anything of them. The arts never flourish much in wartime, but with Mexico at peace, the art of bullfighting is flourishing now to a greater degree in Mexico than in Spain. The difficulty is in the difference in size, temperament, and nerve of the Spanish bulls, which, when the young Mexicans come to Spain, they are not used to, and so are often after the most brilliant work caught and gored, not through any defects in their technique, but simply because they are working with animals more nervous, powerful, and difficult to judge than those of their own country. You cannot have a great bullfighter that is not gored sooner or later, but if you gore him too early, too often, and too young, he will never be the bullfighter he might have been if the bulls had respected him. When you judge the placing of a pair of banderillas, the thing to notice is how high the man raises his arms when he puts in the sticks, since the higher he raises them, the closer he lets the bull come to his body. Notice, too, the amount of circle or cuarteo he uses to cut across the bull's charge. The more he cuarteos, the safer it is. In a really good pair, the man puts his feet together as he raises his hands, and in the cambios and so-called quiebros, You should watch how well he waits and how close he lets the bull come before he shifts his feet. The merits of banderillas placed from the barrera depend entirely on whether the maneuver is tricked or not by capes flung over from behind the barrera to attract the bull's attention. When working in the center of the ring, the man, when he comes toward the bull, has two men with capes some distance away on each side, but they are to distract the bull if he pursues the man after the sticks are planted. When placing banderillas from against the barrera, it may be necessary to flop a cape over after the banderillas have been placed to protect the man if he has gotten into an impossible position. But a cape flopped over each time at the moment of placing means that it is only a trick. Among the actual matadors, the best performers with the banderillas are Manolo Mejías, Bienvenida, Jesús Sorozano, José González, Canacerito de México, Fermín Espinoza, Almillita Segundo, and Heriberto García. Antonio Márquez, Félix Rodríguez, and Marcial Alanda are very interesting with the banderillas. Lalanda sometimes puts in excellent pairs, but he usually makes much too big a quarter of a circle past the bull's head. Márquez has difficulty dominating and placing the bull, and when he puts the banderillas in close to the barrera, almost always has the bull tricked into driving his horns against the wood to make him shy of the barrier, and at the time he is driving in his pair, has a peon flop a cape over the barrier to distract the bull while he makes his escape. Félix Rodríguez is a splendid banderillero, but has been ill and lacks the necessary physical strength to banderillar well. When he is at his best, he is perfect. Fausto Barajas, Julian Saith, Saleri Segundo, and Juan Espinoza, Almillita, were excellent banderilleros, but are on the decline. Saleri may have retired by the time this is published. Ignacio Sánchez Mejías was a very great banderillero who has also retired as a matador, but his style was heavy and graceless. There are half a dozen young Mexicans who are as good as any of these matadors who, by the time this book is published, may be dead, ruined, or famous. Of banderilleros working as peons under the orders of matadors, the best with the sticks that I know are Luis Suárez, Magritas, Joaquín Manzanares, Mella, Antonio Duarte, Rafael Valera, Rafaelillo, Mariano Carrato, Antonio García, Bombita Cuarto, and with the cape, Manuel Aguilar, Rere, and Bonifacio Perea, Boni, Bienvenida's peón de confianza or confidential banderillero. The greatest peon with the cape that I ever saw was Enrique Berenguet, Blanquet. The best banderilleros are often men who have wanted to be matadors, but having failed in their trials with the sword, have resigned themselves to the position of working for wages in the cuadrilla. They often know more about bulls than the matador they are working for, and often have more personality and style. But they are in a servile position and must be careful not to take any of the attention away from their chief. The only man in bullfighting who really makes money is the matador. This is right in that he takes the responsibility and runs the greatest danger of death. But good picadors who receive only 250 pesetas and banderilleros who are paid 250 to 300 are ridiculously underpaid if the matador is receiving 10,000 pesetas and over. If they are not good at their trade, they are a definite liability to the matador and are expensive at any price. But as it is, no matter how good they become at their profession, they cannot become more than day laborers compared to the matadors. The very best banderilleros and picadors are in great demand, and a half dozen of each may have as many as 80 fights in a season. But there are many good and capable ones who make a bare living. They are organized into a syndicate, and matadors must pay them a minimum wage. This varies depending on the matador's ranking. They are divided into three categories according to the price they receive for fighting. But there are many more banderilleros than there are opportunities to fight, and a matador may get them at any price he wishes if he is mean enough, by making them sign a note for a certain amount of the money they should receive and holding out this amount when he pays them. In spite of how badly paid a profession it is, these men keep on living always close to hunger from the illusion that they may make a living from the bulls and from the pride of being fighters. Banderilleros are sometimes lean, brown, young, brave, skillful, and confident, more of a man than their matador, perhaps deceiving him with his mistress, making what seems to them a good living, enjoying the life. Other times they are respectable fathers of families, wise about bulls, fat but still fast on their feet, small businessmen with bulls as their business. Other times they are tough, unintelligent, but brave and capable, lasting like ball players as long as their legs hold out. Others may be brave but unskillful, eking out a living, or they may be old and intelligent but with their legs gone, sought out by young fighters for their authority in the ring and their skill at placing bulls correctly. Blanquette was a very small man, very serious and honorable, with a Roman nose and an almost gray face, who had the greatest intelligence of the bullfight I have ever seen, and a cape that seemed magic in correcting the faults of a bull. He was the confidential peon of Joselito, Granero, and Litri, all of whom were killed by bulls, and to none of whom his cape, so providential always when needed, was of any use on the days when they were killed. Blanquette himself died of a heart attack coming on in a hotel room after he had left the ring and before he had changed his clothes to bathe. Of the banderilleros working now, the one with the most style with the sticks is probably Magritas. There is no one with the cape who has the style Blanquette had. He handled the cape with one hand with the same sort of delicacy that Rafael El Gallo did, but with the skillful, self-effacing modesty of a peon. It was watching the interest and activities of Blanquette at moments when nothing particular seemed to be happening that I learned the profundity of unseen detail in the fighting of any single bull. Do you want conversation? What about? Something about painting? Something to please Mr. Huxley? Something to make the book worthwhile? All right, this is the end of a chapter. We can put it in. Well, when Julius Meyer Graefe, the German critic, came to Spain, he wanted to see the Goyas and Velázquezes to have publishable ecstasies about them. But he liked the Greco better. He was not content to like Greco better, he had to like him alone. So he wrote a book proving what poor painters Goya and Velázquez were in order to exalt Greco. And the yardstick that he chose to judge these painters by was their respective paintings of the crucifixion of our Lord. Now, it would be hard to do anything stupider than this because of the three, only Greco believed in our Lord or took any interest in his crucifixion. You can only judge a painter by the way he paints the things he believes in or cares for and the things he hates. And to judge Velázquez, who believed in costume and in the importance of painting his painting, by a portrait of a nearly naked man on a cross, who had been painted, Velázquez must have felt, very satisfactorily in the same position before, and in whom Velázquez took no interest at all, is not intelligent. Goya was like Stendhal. The sight of a priest could stimulate either of those good anti-clericals into a rage of production. Goya's crucifixion is a cynically romantic wooden oleograph that could serve as a poster for the announcement of crucifixions in the manner of bullfight posters. A crucifixion of six carefully selected Christs will take place at 5 o'clock in the monumental Golgotha of Madrid, government permission having been obtained. The following well-known, accredited, and notable crucifiers will officiate, each accompanied by his quadrilla of nailers, hammerers, cross-raisers, and spademen, etc. Greco liked to paint religious pictures because he was very evidently religious. And because his incomparable art was not then limited to accurate reproducing of the faces of the noblemen who were his sitters for portraits, and he could go as far into his other world as he wanted, and consciously or unconsciously paint saints, apostles, Christs, and virgins with the androgynous faces and forms that filled his imagination. One time in Paris, I was talking to a girl who was writing a fictionalized life of El Greco, and I said to her, "Do you make him a maricón?" "No," she said. "Why should I?" "Did you ever look at the pictures?" "Yes, of course." "Did you ever see more classic examples anywhere than he painted? Do you think that was all accident, or do you think all those citizens were queer? The only saint I know who is universally represented as built that way is San Sebastian. Greco made them all that way. Look at the pictures. Don't take my word for it." "I hadn't thought of that." "Think it over," I said, "if you're writing a life of him."
"It's too late now," she said. "The book is done."
Velázquez believed in painting in costume, in dogs, in dwarfs, and in painting again. Goya did not believe in costume, but he did believe in blacks and in grays, in dust and in light, in high places rising from plains, in the country around Madrid, in movement, in his own cojones, in painting, in etching, and in what he had seen, felt, touched, handled, smelled, enjoyed, drunk, mounted, suffered, spewed up, lain with, suspected, observed, loved, hated, lusted, feared, detested, admired, loathed, and destroyed. Naturally, no painter has been able to paint all that, but he tried. El Greco believed in the city of Toledo, in its location and construction, in some of the people who lived in it, in blues, grays, greens, and yellows, in reds, in the Holy Ghost, in the communion and fellowship of saints, in painting, in the life after death and death after life, and in fairies. If he was one, he should redeem for the tribe the prissy exhibitionist ant-like withered old maid moral arrogance of Egide, the lazy, conceited debauchery of a wild who betrayed a generation, the nasty, sentimental pawing of humanity of a Whitman, and all the mincing gentry. Viva el Greco, el rey de los maricones!